3. The expanded forecast turning cooler, highs in the 40s for Wednesday and Thursday under sunny skies. Right now, a temperature reading of 52. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Here's part one. And I'm so excited for the next few minutes to be able to speak with a scientist by the name of Hope Jaron, who has just penned a really extraordinary memoir called Lab Girl, in which she explores some of the intriguing work that she has done in the field of paleobiology and pivots, in a sense, back and forth between her observations of the wonders of the world of plants and her own development, both as a human being and as a scientist. And I've read more than one review that has been taken by the parallels that one can draw between, for instance, the resiliency and persistence that a plant demonstrates in the setting down of its roots and at the reaching upward of its branches, and our own development as human beings. And certainly Hope Jaron writes beautifully and eloquently about that in her book, again called Lab Girl. For the last few years, she has been a tenured professor at the University of Hawaii. And she has constructed several different research labs in the field of paleobiology. Again, the book is called Lab Girl, published by Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. Hope Jaron, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm so excited to be speaking with you. I absolutely love the book. And I think one of the best things you do in this book is that you shake us loose from certain mistaken presumptions that we might make, and one of them being that the typical scientist doesn't necessarily care about words. You say at one point, no writer in the world agonizes over words the way a scientist does. Clearly, you are someone who really loves words and wields them well, although I think in that particular point, you're not necessarily talking about yourself as a creative writer, but certainly you have great talents in that respect as well. Just say a word about the importance of words to a serious scientist.
Oh, scientists do a lot of writing as part of their jobs. We write reports, we write proposals, we have to ask for the money that we spend. I don't think that's something the public generally knows, but if I get an idea of some experiment I'd like to do, I've got to write a long thing asking for resources to do it, you know, justifying that this is, of all the different things we could do, we've thought about it hard, and this is what we want to do. And then when I'm done, I have to write and say, this is what we accomplished. And often I'm writing these reports or magazine articles, journal articles, and I'm trying to distill, you know, years worth of work by several people down to just a few pages, just a few pages of report. And it's got to have everything in it. It's got to show why we did it, what we did when we did it. And that's a special kind of writing. And there's not a lot of room to talk about, you know, how you felt when you did it and all the stuff that didn't work and the people, you know, it all comes down to those bare bones. And that's what really propelled me to write this other kind of book, because I thought those stories were building up, the stories of, you know, it had been our lives. And we'd done unusual things and worked hard and sacrificed and all those things. And I thought, you know, that deserved to be written down of its own right. And that's where the book came from.
Absolutely. You tell us that you started out studying literature, but in your words, soon discovered that science was where I actually belonged. And then you go on to make such a telling distinction between, in a sense, the discipline of literature and the discipline of science. What is the heart and soul of the most important difference between the two? And why was science the place where you belonged?
Well, the big difference that I saw was that when we talked about literature, we talked about the past. We talked about these classics. And we talked about how they had been rewritten from the great Greek classics. And we talked about civilizations that didn't exist anymore and tried to get into ways of thinking that were no longer there. And in my science classes, we talked about today and diseases that needed cure and things that needed built and society's problems and how we could solve them. We talked about the future and how we could make it happen. And that was a big difference for me. And then it also went back to my very earliest roots. I mean, the book is called Lab Girl because I was a girl in the lab. My very first memories are of being a very little girl in the lab, how it felt and sounded and the glassware and the hum of the instruments. And I realized that that was what I wanted, that was what I wanted to build for myself as an adult. And so going into science and getting trained, you know, to do that as a research career, that's when I started to feel really like I was coming back to the place where I was meant to be.
Explain what your father did, the kind of scientist that he was.
He was a community college teacher, and he taught in a rural Minnesota community college for 42 consecutive years. And he taught physics and chemistry and earth science and all the sciences. And he had a lab where folks learned, you know, what those subjects were. And in the evenings, he would go there and set up for the next day. And my brothers and I would go with him. And we learned how to fix the instruments and maintain them. And he also was, you know, the most incredibly patient and wonderful. He loved being there. That's why he wanted to go and take us. And he never, ever said no if we wanted to take it all out and play with it. And I did. I thought it was play. You know, I thought these were toys, but I knew they were important. You know, they were important things for grown-ups. But for me, it was just such a joy to be there and to work things with my hands. And I always knew that this was where I belonged. And that feeling stayed with me, you know, when I got to harder courses in college or if I was the only girl in the class or whatever. I just had a strong sense that I belonged there and I could do things there. Yeah. And that was for me.
As you write at one point, people are like plants. They grow toward the light. I chose science because science gave me what I needed, a home as defined in the most literal sense, a safe place to be. And you go on in that same chapter to talk more literally about the lab or labs in which you have worked for so much of your adult life. I want you to talk about a couple of aspects of work in the lab that makes the lab such a wonderful, even beautiful place for you to be. For one thing, you say, my lab is a place where I can be the child that I still am. What do you mean by that?
Well, it often feels like it did when I was very little and I was helping with the instruments and I was fixing them and maintaining them. And, you know, you run through the exercise that the students are going to do and make sure it goes right. It's that every day of it, working with your hands and being in this place that I still am very, very much in touch with how wonderful that felt when I was so very little, and it was my favorite thing, and it was my father's favorite thing, and that was, you know, wonderful. And the fact that I have that for myself, that I built that for myself, is just, you know, it's the most wonderful thing I've done. And it's the everyday of it. you know, picking up things and looking around you and just being there. That's the best part, is the joy that we get from just the everyday stuff.
Right. You also say something that I think most people will find surprising when you say, my laboratory is like a church. And we know you know what a church is because you mentioned growing up in a Presbyterian church and being baptized there and attending there very regularly. So you're not speaking in abstract terms here. But explain to our listeners why you say that, that your laboratory is like a church.
Well, I think you enter it and you try to be your best self. You know, it's a place that becomes familiar and you know who's going to be there, and you know how everybody's going to kind of act. And it's a place where you kind of come together, but you also kind of leave each other alone. And there's kind of music, but it's not really the point of it. And there's kind of sitting by yourself, but that's not really the point of it. And there's kind of, you know, picking up things and putting them down. But that's, you know, that the whole thing is something bigger, that what you get out of it is what you do, what you get from doing it over and over again for years. That's where the meaning comes from. And I thought those were similar. And it was a similar feeling. It's also open on Sundays when the rest of the world is closed.
Right.
You know?
I also appreciate, as I said in the intro, I love how you alternate between not only the discussion of your life as a scientist, but also beautiful observations about the world around us and a world that so many of us are oblivious to. I want you to, just to, as one of many examples in the book, I want you to say a quick word about the beauty and wonder of an amazing substance called wood, something we so take for granted. Just say a word about the amazing qualities of wood.
Well, wood is all around us. I mean, I think we stop seeing it, but if you stop what you're doing right now, and of course a lot of stuff is plastic and metal, but there's still so much of the everyday building materials that we use are wood. And the amazing thing about wood is it used to be part of a living thing. It was a living tissue that was built day by day. If you look across and you see rings, you know how trees make rings. If you look across those rings, you can see the time, the life journey of that thing recorded in those rings. And wood is like nothing else. It's light and it's strong and it's flexible. You can compare all its properties to, say, steel and all these kind of human-made substances, and it's really something other. You could never make artificial wood. It is sort of what it is, and we use it for all these purposes, but trees use it for a very different purpose. They use it to reach up and reach down at the same time, which is really what makes a tree different from all other plants, is it can reach up so very high compared to things like grasses and bushes and stuff like that. So I love wood because it's all around us, because we stop seeing it, and I love the way somebody's eyes light up when you tell them something that makes sense, and they say, that's all around me, and now I see it differently.
Mm.
It's a big goal. It's the biggest goal for an educator that there is. Can I make you see the world differently than you do now? But it's if you get it right, it's the most wonderful thing in the world.
Right, and we so appreciate your gift for observation, as, for instance, when you talk about your most potent memory of the garden at the home where you grew up was not how it smelled or looked, but how it sounded, the sounds of a garden growing. I mean, you awaken us in your book to all kinds of beauties that we would entirely miss. The book is Lab Girl, published by Vintage Books, and the book and the author, Hope Jaron. Hope Jaron, I loved your book, and I hope you will find time in your busy life as a scientist to do more of this kind of writing and share it with the world. And I thank you for being part of the Morning Show today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And now for part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. The 11th of March is a wonderful fundraiser coming up for something called the Koss Family Foundation. This event on the 11th is called Art in the Speakeasy. It will occur at the Racine Business Center with the galleries on 16th. And it is designed to help the Koss Family Foundation, which has been created to offer financial support to families contending with cancer and help to contend with some of the non-medical expenses that can be part of this ordeal. That is something experienced firsthand by Steve and Becky Koss, who shared their very powerful and poignant story on a recent morning show. Here's a portion of our conversation. Also on hand, Emily Montgomery and Samira Gadisis, two of the organizers of this weekend's fundraiser for the Koss Family Foundation. Here Steve Koss describes when he first learned of his diagnosis.
Well, back in 2015, I wasn't feeling good, and they thought I had a gallbladder. Gallbladder.
Right. They thought you needed your gallbladder out. You had gallstones.
So, went to the hospital and basically did some tests and some scans and found out that there was no blockage there, and they've seen something else there. And by the end of that night, I was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, stage 2. Which, you know, kind of, you always say it's not going to happen to you, you know, and kind of hits you in the face, and you're kind of thrown in this whirlwind of things start to happen, and I don't think you can really absorb it all at that particular moment. And so we went to Frater and started a vigorous campaign of chemotherapy and radiation for 3 months. Hopefully, and the outview of that was to see if they could perform surgery on me after that treatment. And after that treatment, it had went to stage 4 to my liver and my lungs. After that, we had went to a cancer treatment center for second opinions, and so that's currently where I'm getting treated now. So after going through almost a year of chemotherapy, my tumor markers were down to like 49 or...
In the normal range.
In the normal range, which was good news. But as a doctor reminded me, it's a sleeping giant.
Mm.
And sleeping dragon. So it was really nice. I had all last summer off of chemotherapy.
Wow.
So I got to really enjoy life.
Mm.
And we've been trying to do that. And I have a going to be 9-year-old son, and so we're trying to take some trips and spend some time with him.
Sure.
So as of today, I went back before Christmas hoping to get good news again. Well, my tumor markers are up to about 1,200 right now. So I'm back on chemotherapy, and we're going to see where that takes us.
Mm.
But, you know, I look at every day as a blessing and don't take anything for granted, and I still look to the future.
Very good. So in other words, for you, this regimen of chemotherapy, which I'm sure is not fun, but has had some significant effect in terms of at least slowing this and buying you what is so very, very precious, which is the gift of time.
Right. Yep. And that's what it's all about. It's not, you know, right now it becomes quality of life, you know, and how long you can live and cherish that.
And how well you can live.
Right. Exactly. Right.
I'm sure that one thing you, you're better equipped than any of us to be grateful for the small things. I should think one thing that you're perhaps grateful for is that chemotherapy is not what it once was, that even just a few years ago, just the word conjured up such horrors because it was as yet a relatively new science, not yet understood fully, and it could be have such devastating effect. And my understanding anyway is that they've come a long, long way, and that chemotherapy itself, as it does the good it's supposed to do, does not quite cause what it used to. That being said, I'm sure it's still a very difficult road to travel.
Well, it is, and we have to remember that cancer affects everybody different. You know, I mean, I have pancreatic cancer, but someone could be next to me and have pancreatic cancer and be completely different.
Mm.
All depending on where it is and how your body reacts to it. The same thing applies to chemotherapy. So there could be five of us on the same cocktail, they call it, because they mix chemos together. And each one of us could have different side effects or react different to that same medication.
Hmm.
So that's what's kind of unique about it. I've been pretty lucky to the first 3 months that I was on chemo with some pretty strong stuff. I was on a pump, and I would take it home for the weekend, 24 hours a day. They were pumping it into me, and then that was a very brutal chemo.
Hmm.
Now I'm on a more, well, for me, my body, I can't talk for anybody else, but right now the chemo I'm on right now is pretty light on my body. So it's not as abusive as the other chemo I was on. I mean, it still isn't fun, but, the hardest thing about this whole thing. The hardest thing for me was actually cutting my hair off.
You cut your hair off. You took it off yourself.
Yep. I thought I was prepared for that.
Hmm.
But regardless of the chemo, I accepted that fine. Something about cutting your hair off.
Hmm. That made it real? Is that, or that's...
That made it real.
Hmm.
And there's other people I talked to that said the same thing, you know, that once that day came when your hair was falling out, you know, in respect to other people, I wanted to cut it off. So if I was out in public at a restaurant or someplace, that my hair wasn't falling all over.
Right.
So it was very hard. My nephews. I came over and helped cut my hair.
They all shaved their heads too.
Wow.
Even the one in Texas was on the iPad, and his wife was shaving his head and Skyping with us the whole time.
Wow.
It became a little family event that all the boys were there doing.
Wow. So it's... on the one hand, it's a road you're traveling alone, and yet not alone at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Becky, I suspect this is, just as Steve never imagined this was going to be part of his life, nor could you have imagined this is going to be part of something that you would be confronting. Tell us what this road has been like for you and the ways in which you have tried to be everything you need to be for Steve through a road like this.
Well, when you're a nurse and you see blood work and you see symptoms, you see too much. As a spouse, you try not to see that. So the night before he was supposed to go in for his ultrasound, for the gallbladder ultrasound, I had a feeling. I knew. And when...
Excuse me. So are you have some training as a nurse? Is that...
I've been a nurse for almost 18 years.
Oh, wow. Yes. I didn't realize that or remember that. So,
yes.
Okay, please continue.
So the night before his... we got the results. I just had this feeling, and he had gone to, we had to see the surgeon, And I called a friend. I said, you know, I think it's pancreatic cancer. And then when we got the results, they said, no, it's his gallbladder. He's, you know, the gallbladder is enlarged and we need to take this out. And I said, oh, we're in the surgeon's office. And I said, thank God I was wrong. He said, why? I said, because I thought it was pancreatic cancer, not your gallbladder. And he said, well, what's with pancreatic cancer? I said, well, that one's not good. And then the surgeon came in and said, there's no, I can't find any stones in the gallbladder. I want to go do a CT scan to look for rogue stones in outlying areas, maybe in a bile duct. And I was like, not a big deal, until they came back and said, we aren't doing surgery. We're going to get biopsies. And then I knew the spouse in me had taken over the nurse.
Right.
So then you're just, I was talking to a friend about this, who was also a nurse, whose brother is going through cancer treatment. I said, you know, as the family member, as the spouse, those years of being a nurse, and that kind of goes out the window a little bit, because you're so focused on what you can do as the family member, as a spouse, and you're not always thinking in those medical ways that you've been trained to do, and you just do everything you can. I mean, when he was first diagnosed, there was nights a coworker of mine said, you know, you can't post on CaringBridge at 4 a.m. You should probably be sleeping. And you don't sleep. You're up all night and you're trying to figure all this out, because it's a whole new world, and getting everything in order, you know, you still have those day-to-days, but you still have to go to those doctor's appointments, figure out this new schedule and treatment plans. And we have a little boy, and we still had to get him to first grade and try to get keep his life in order too.
Wow. I'm trying to figure out if you're grateful that you have this background of understanding. And Steve, I'm curious if you're grateful for that too. That I mean, for as hard as that makes it, perhaps it takes away a little of the just bewilderment and confusion that, for just, you know, when somebody's just a, you know, a bricklayer and a baker or whoever, I mean, that know nothing about this world, that you're suddenly a part of, sort of first person. What kind of difference has that made in terms of being able to navigate this difficult road?
I think it makes a big difference, because, you know, I have that background, and I understand what is happening, where there's a lot of terms, there's a lot of tests, there's a lot of it's like a foreign language when you walk into a hospital and you're going for treatment. And, you know, I have the understanding, I know what that is, and I can explain it, because, you know, that diagnosis is you're hearing it, you're listening to them talk, but it's kind of like the Charlie Brown teacher. You know, you hear it, but it's like, wah, wah, wah.
Right.
And it doesn't all sink in. So having that understanding, the basic understanding, I was never an oncology nurse. I was, you know, never. I'm a diabetes educator now. But just having that basic understanding makes it much easier waters to navigate. Because when you talk to people who don't have that understanding, you know, it's definitely a benefit, you know, because they don't understand what's going on, or they get confused about things and really don't know what they're doing. They're just doing whatever the doctor wants them to. And you might not have that insight to go, well, what other options are there, or what does this really mean?
Right. I have a brother who suffered a traumatic brain injury several years ago, fortunately made a very good recovery, but I have a sister who's a medical doctor, and there were many times that we were so grateful that in our midst, in our complete ignorance, that she was there to explain what this was or that was, and it made a dark road a little bit brighter to walk. Steve, what kind of difference do you think it's made that Becky has, in addition to all of her love for you, also this this knowledge of medical procedures and terminology and so on. What kind of difference has it made in being helpful to you?
Well, first of all, I have a beautiful wife. And then I have a very good friend. And then I have a nurse. So, you know, and before this happened, you know, the nurse was at the hospital. And my friend and my wife came home.
Right. Interesting way to put it.
So now all three of them in our life every day.
Right.
So, and it really helps me when she can explain some of the things because, you know, I mean, these doctors are all in a hurry and sometimes, you know, I don't understand it all, especially when you start going on chemo, your brain doesn't function like it used to. Mm. So it's really been a great help that, you know, my wife, nurse, my best friend can explain that to me.
Right. I'm sure that makes a big, big difference. So let's talk about the Koss Family Foundation. When was that created?
Well, I'll talk about the first part, and then my wife can talk about how she started it. Back in August, my...
Of 2015,
my niece, Tammy Jensen, had planned a benefit for me to help pay for some medical bills. And to my surprise, we had... I mean, I've run a couple businesses in my life, and I've been around, so I know a lot of people. But I had no clue that roughly 900 people were going to show up.
Wow.
From out of state. I mean, they were coming in from everywhere. And so I was really grateful for that, for those people helping us out. So after that, my wife kept saying she was going to have this Christmas present for me. You know, she always dangles stuff out there, you know. It doesn't really drive me crazy, but it does her. But, you know, I was kind of like, okay, where are we going, to Tahiti? Or, you know, I'm thinking, we're going to take a trip, or... I'm an avid fisherman, so I'm thinking, maybe she's going to buy me a new bass boat or something. You know,
right.
He bought his own bass boat.
Okay.
But so then she can take over from there how she started the foundation up.
Wow. I have a feeling that was the Christmas surprise.
It was. I tried to figure out how I could give back because it was just overwhelming. You know, we knew we had great friends, but we didn't know half of the people there were not just close friends and family. Over half, there were just people who saw it, people who wanted to help, just community members. And this wasn't even held in the city. It was held in Union Grove. So it wasn't just people, you know, from Racine, the city of Racine itself. It was outlying areas. And so I was just kind of researching, and, you know, as a nurse, I don't have much business background. So I was at Barnes & Noble with a book on how to start up a nonprofit, and I texted my two closest friends and said, let's go to dinner. I have an idea. And I'm sure they thought I was absolutely crazy, and we worked on it. And we just would go out to dinner once a week and just really, you know, follow the steps and start. I started looking and researching and went to Marquette University, their law school, and got free law help and just started the whole process. And we incorporated December of 2015, and we presented Steve with those incorporation papers, and we have them framed, and that was his Christmas present, was the foundation in his name to help other families.
Wow.
Luckily, through MLINK, we found out, because we were just a startup, we could fill out the short form for the 501c3 and not the 30-some page long form we had been slaving away at. So by May of 2016, we became a nonprofit. And it was our labor of love and support. And we had so many people just help us financial donations to pay for all of it, because it's expensive to get a foundation off and running.
Before you've even taken in the money that you want to disperse, you have to lay out some money.
You have
to
lay out a lot
of
money to, you know, all the incorporation fees. There's so many different things that you need that luckily we had free law help with that, and yeah. It was fantastic.
Wow. So that was a heck of a lot better than new fishing poles or whatever, or golf clubs.
Yep, it was unbelievable. And, you know, going through cancer, you know, going to the hospital every day, which I did back in 2015, I lived there. You get to meet people, a lot of people. There's a lot of sad stories out there. There really is. You know, we just heard another one the other day. A person passed away in a hotel because they took his house. And so there's really a lot of bad cases out there. And there's a lot of good foundations out there, you know. And you can take a trip, and that's great for building memories. And they're all good foundations. But by the end of the day, that stress level of making sure you have a home, if it's your child that has cancer, or even if it's your spouse, to be able to maintain that just normal way of living.
Let alone the special perks.
Exactly.
Keeping regular life going.
Right. Just going down the same path you were going becomes pretty rough.
Right.
And so I'm really happy that this foundation, I'm looking to the future. I probably won't see it, but I'm looking to the future where we can make a huge, huge difference on people's lives in the future.
Well, and in this way that a lot of us sort of on the outside, not directly impacted by this, just doesn't even dawn on us. I mean, we might be so caught up just in the headlines that you forget about underneath just the more sort of normal story that we want sustained, that needs to be sustained. So that's kind of the focus then of your foundation.
Yes, to pay the non-medical expenses. Most hospitals have, you know, patient assistance programs to help with medical bills, but when you're losing wages for, you know, to go to treatment or take your child to treatment, just not being able to work, how do you pay the mortgage? How do you pay for the car that's going to get you there, the gas that'll get you there? Your kids still have school. They still have to pay for books. You need utilities. You need a phone to get those phone calls, to make those doctor's appointments. So that's where we come in, just to help maintain that normalcy, because it takes, when you have a terminal medical diagnosis, the fast track to get disability is still 6-7 months. And you're not working. There's no other income coming in. We both had very successful careers, and, you know, this takes that away. It doesn't matter, you know, how much money you make or anything. When you can't work, when you're not making that money, those bills are still there, plus the added expense of the treatment.
Right, that reality. And again, it's something the rest of us just aren't mindful of.
Right, and we never, you know, up until 2 years ago, we never would have thought that, you know, you don't realize those expenses.
Right. So now that the Costs Family Foundation is off the ground, yeah, so now it becomes about the matter of spreading the word and of inviting people to demonstrate their own generosity. What kind of response has there been thus far?
Oh, there's been a huge response. We've made great connections with different organizations like Salmon Unlimited, the now closed Curbs Racine, King for a Cure, and now these two ladies here, Emily and Samira, who have been huge supporters. So just different places like that, you know, people have just stepped up and really tried to help us as much as possible and to get this off the ground, because cancer touches everybody. You know, if you walked into a room, you could ask people, you know, raise your hands if you know somebody, if you've worked with somebody who has cancer, or if anybody in their family had cancer. Somebody's going to raise their hand. And so once you tell them what you're doing, that passion is there, and they're so wanting to help other people because they know what it's like.
I suppose it says something about what people think of you, Steve, that that this has taken off as it has.
Well, I don't know whether it's good or bad they think about me, but, you know, it looks like it's good. It's funny that you say that because I don't know her last name, but she, Gretchen, she ran Curves in Racine, and I just seen her a couple weeks ago, and I said, you know what, Gretchen, I said, I'm kind of looking at you that you got us rolling in this whole foundation as far as raising money, and it was just, she invited us to a Curves event. And then from there we met Mary Lee Hetland, which is works on the Sam Unlimited board, and so it just kind of like spiraled from there who we met at that one particular event, and it just blossomed into, you know, this person to this person, hey, this person can help you, let me introduce you to this person, and it just one after the other. We had an event in we had a fall festival, Cost Family Fall Festival in October, and there was our vice president of the executive board called Pumpkin Farm in the middle of Wisconsin. Well, I ended up driving up there because they were donating 500 pumpkins to us. And they said, never met these people before, and they said, whatever you need in the future, call us. And doesn't matter, just pick up the phone and call us.
Wow.
And we'll help you out. I mean, so that's what it's been all about. We had a bunch of pumpkins left over, of course, but we gave them to the zoo for their event that day, and it was we gave away free pumpkins. It was so it's all good all the way around.
Wow. So are you in the business yet of dispersing funds, or is that down the road, you once that you've gotten the foundation to a certain place financially?
Right now we have, well, last August, right after we became a 501c3, we were contacted by somebody, and we just accepted that person's application, and we will be giving out our first monies. Mm. So it's slow because we have, you know, limited finances, but we're hoping that with our next event, we will be set up to put up money, give money out once a month to one family. And that's our goal for this fiscal year of 2017. So our application isn't out publicly yet, but if we are contacted, we have been giving that application out.
Right.
Because we don't have the funds yet.
Of course.
We are really trying and working super hard to get those funds and to get to help the families.
Right. Well, and I can't imagine how good it will feel for you to sign that first check.
Right.
I mean, in reverse to the moment it, you know, when you cut off your hair and it's like made it real. It's like the moment you get to sign that first check, that will make this real in a way that it's real now, but it really becomes real at that moment.
Then our vision is there, it's complete, and we know that we're on the right track, we're doing the right thing, and that goal will be met, and I have everything. We're having the meeting, and that should be like within soon that will be finalized.
And a red letter day indeed.
Yes.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking today on the morning show with Becky Koss and Steve Koss, and talking about the Koss Family Foundation. And also with us today in the studios, Samira Gadisis and Emily Montgomery, who are with Gallery on 16th and the 16th Street Studios in Racine. And that is going to be the location for a very, very special event coming up on the 11th of March, which will be one hopes a spectacular fundraiser for the Koss Family Foundation. So, Emily Montgomery, I think at this point we want to draw you into the conversation and find out how you and the studios on 16th became part of this effort to support the Koss Family Foundation.
Well, Becky and Steve approached Racine Business Center to rent space for their foundation. Steve's family has a long history in our building. His father, Bob Koss, worked for my family's business, Racine Industries, for my entire life. I don't know how many years, but until he retired.
Yeah. Small world.
Right. Well, it's all family. And so when they approached us for space, I was really excited because when they presented what their foundation does, actually, ironically, I could be their poster child for being a recipient of what they want to present to people. I was diagnosed with stage 3 colon cancer in my 30s. I had 5 children. I was still nursing a baby. And we were running a farm ministry in Minnesota.
A what?
A farm ministry. We brought inner city kids from North Minneapolis to our farm, give them a farm. And yeah, and so when I was diagnosed with cancer, I chose to do an alternate route. And I didn't take chemo. So everything that I did, my treatments, were all out of pocket. My husband had a job, but we were a family of 7. Running a farm, we were raising support as missionaries for this farm ministry, living on very little income, and we ended up having to sell the farm 3 years after my diagnosis to pay all of the debt that was incurred through my alternative treatments. It obviously worked because 15 years later, I'm still here.
Wow.
So when they moved into the building, I was super excited because had there been a Koss Family Foundation for someone like me 15 years ago, we might not have had to uproot our 5 children and move from our farm and and have to give up this ministry that we were doing. So it was just a natural fit for them because now I'm super passionate about what they're doing. We had, in the building a few years ago, we had hosted a wine tasting party for Racine Montessori School and got the artists involved in that. They donated artwork. They opened their studios. It really lent a lot of ambiance to the wine tasting evening, and it was quite a success. So when Becky and Steve started renting from us, and I told them, we were walking around the building, and I showed them the area where the 16th Street Studios are in the building, and told them about this wine tasting party, and I think that probably planted the seed in their minds of what kind of fundraising they could do. And Samira, being our gallery director extraordinaire, obviously brought her into it, but she is an amazing designer with her Black Eyed Press studio, and she's created all the artwork for it and has just been doing an amazing job.
And so this event coming up this weekend is a major fundraiser for the Koss Family Foundation. The event is called Art in the Speakeasy. And the event is the 11th of March at the Racine Business Center and the gallery on 16th, which is housed within it. And the facility is located on 16th Street between Junction and Memorial. And the entire building essentially is going to be turned into an old-fashioned speakeasy. People are encouraged, although by no means required, to wear vintage costumes of the 1920s. The event will include delicious food and drink, an art auction, and all kinds of fun. And the monies raised will go to benefit this newly formed Koss Family Foundation, which seeks to offer up financial support for non-medical expenses incurred by families contending with cancer. And for more information, you can go to the Koss Family Foundation website, which is kossff.org. That's K-O-S-S-F-F racinebusiness.org. You can purchase tickets for the fundraiser at the Racine Business Center, and tickets are also being sold at Uncorked in downtown Racine. My thanks to Steve and Becky Koss, Samira Gadisis, and Emily Montgomery for joining me for this memorable edition of The Morning Show here on WGTD. We remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and you can